and from a democratic, from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And here we are. We're live now, and we were live. We're live again. And today, our co-host on Socialist Alternative Radio and an interviewee is Nick Wurst.
Hello, hello.
And Nick did a radio podcast for Socialist Alternative out at Worcester State University. And just today, through happenstance, through some stuff we had to get done here politically in the area, Nick decided to come on. Very nice of you, Nick, to take time off of your busy schedule.
Yeah, thanks.
Come all the way from Worcester. How do you say Worcester?
Worcester. I mean,
Worcester, Massachusetts.
Nobody can agree, not even people who live there. People,
what are their variations?
Worcester, 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 you know, which is what I do.
Worcester.
Worcester, Worcester. It's all over the place, man. People can't decide whether to leave in the R's or the A's or the O's or whatever.
Well, people on, like, built, you know, like when you call, like, companies, and they have to say the word, it's really funny.
Yeah.
Worcester?
Yeah, exactly. Worcester?
All right, so anyway, yeah, millennial socialist, that means, what does millennial mean again? I forget. It just means young, right?
Yeah.
What's the age range?
It's something
born
like,
between X and Y. And
it's born before 2000, but after 1990 or 1985 or something like that.
When were you born?
I was born in 96.
Holy.
Yeah.
Lovely. That's so not that long ago from my perspective.
22 years old, Jeff. How
old
are you?
There you go. Very old. More older than 22. I think I've given my age on the show before, but for right now, I feel somehow awkward about giving my age. I think you set that up. So I would feel ageist. I think I've been ageisted.
Yeah, I'm being ageist.
Anyway, so yeah, no, we thought it would, you know, we'd do an interview with Nick, how he got involved with socialism and socialist alternative. Talk about what we're doing in Worcester a little bit, maybe, whatever. See where it goes. And then later in the show, we'll be talking about the recent labor victory in Missouri. Against right to work legislation, and maybe if we have time, we'll get to the Teamsters contract for United Parcel Service,
UPS,
the private brown truck, brown uniform people that are everywhere, our brothers and sisters in UPS, and there you go. That's kind of where we're going to go today. Once again, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective, and we've been on the air here over a decade on WMFO, and we hope we will continue with that, and we'll throw some music on later too, I think. Now, if you are, what do we say we want to complain about? Lack of vacation time for American workers. Before we interview Nick, we'll just say I'm pissed. I got no vacation. I haven't had vacation. I mean, I got vacation time, but I couldn't afford to go on vacation.
Right.
Just couldn't afford it. Is that your situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's if you can't reach it by car, right, it's kind of out of the question. I mean, for me, I think I start off the year with like 18 days off, and I don't have a
18
separate
vacation days from your job.
I don't have a separate sick time or vacation time.
All lumped together, personal time.
Right,
exactly. Yeah, I hate that.
So it's 18 days for the entire year. And my experience with it this year was that, man, those days goes quick.
Yeah, as Marx said, that's when you only live when you're not working, basically.
Right.
I'm paraphrasing badly, but for workers, living happens after work.
Yeah.
And if you're working a lot, you don't have much time after work. And so if you have very few vacation days, that's even less time to live life. Not being exploited.
I went through those 18 days, I think, already.
Zoom.
And so now I have the rest of the year to try to survive.
Yeah.
And so I can take more time off, right? But then I don't get paid for that time off. And then the paycheck, which is already kind of meager, starts getting a little bit hairy.
You don't want to do that. You don't want to do no pay.
Yeah, exactly.
Work for no pay. Well, I did this thing where me and my wife did this thing where we had to use a lot of our saved up vacation time to cover summer camp expenses, like don't send the kids to summer camp,
right,
or a babysitter or whatever. We don't have family in the area, so no, we're not going to be able to, or family that could, you know, do this. So we had to, you know, switch off and on vacation time. And that's that was barely going to work, and now there's been a big wrench thrown into the whole thing, which is a car. The transmission fluid started leaking, and that's just thrown our whole schedule and everything into a crazy spiral downward, including using a lot of vacation time just to have the car looked at.
Yeah.
And I won't go into the details, but it's just horrible. So now we're wondering if we're gonna run out of vacation time by the end of the month.
Well, it's
really sad.
It's really, I've had...
Forget about not going on vacation. It's you don't even have enough to cover basics, you know?
I have some interesting statistics, but just on the note of car stuff, my transmission got screwed up a few weeks ago. But before that, there were multiple times I had to bring my car to my mechanic. And
you own the mechanic?
No, yeah. To the mechanic I go to. His name is George. He's a good guy.
And you don't own him?
I do not own him.
Okay.
It's
like when people say we about the United States. Oh, we control?
I'm not in Iraq.
Me and the Koch brothers, we have drinks every night at the local bar, you know? I mean, it's just we. It's all over the place, yeah.
Well, so bringing a lot of the time, because my job, I show up at 8:30, and then I get off of work sometime between 5 and 6. It depends how busy we are. So that's... the mechanic doesn't open until 9, and they close at 5. And so during the week, if I have a problem with my car, what the heck am I going to do? Yep. I can't... I'd either have to leave work early. So what I tried doing is if I, you know, on my half an hour lunch that I get, it's unpaid, right? I can drive the car over and have one of my coworkers drive me back. But then if that goes longer than 30 minutes, I start losing money, right? And so it's all these little things.
Yep, all these little things. And they wonder why we don't smile.
Yeah, it's all that avocado toast we're eating, right?
Wait, before I get to the millennial socialist thing, one last thing about cars is also when you pick up your car, they fix it, and it's only available during the week in those hours.
Right.
When do you go pick it up?
Right.
And now you got things. When I was a kid, back when the labor movement was stronger, you had doctors routinely see you and dentists on Saturdays. Dentists and doctors worked all day on Saturday. That was because that's when most working people went to the dentist and doctor. Now, for regular checkups and stuff, you know, regular stuff. Now, I don't know about dentists. I don't think they're open on Saturdays much, are they? I'm not sure about that. I have to double check on that. My kids, my wife takes care of the kids' dentist appointments, and
it's
I don't ever go.
I've been to a dentist.
I don't go to save money.
Know.
Yeah, I don't want to know. Yeah, I can't walk in and have them laugh. I can't walk in and see the look on a dentist's face. They look at my teeth and say,
"When's the last time you flossed?"
Now I can have a vacation. You know, no, I take good care of my teeth. It's just they don't. There's gonna obviously be something wrong, you know, and they're gonna get that smile on their face like I've paid their son's college tuition. And I'm not gonna do that.
Yeah,
I'm not doing it. I'm just not, you know. And they wonder why people have bad teeth, whatever. So anyway, the thing with what we talk about the car, right? Well, how do I arrange to pick up my car? I'm gonna lose time from work, use up more of that vacation time that I needed to cover my kids, so my kids didn't need babysitting or summer camp or something, you know.
Right.
So.
You want to hear something that's going to make you real depressed?
No, it'll make me angry. I'm a socialist. I don't get depressed. I get even. I'm going to get even, man. Go ahead.
So, in the U.S., we have federally mandated only
Who's we? Kimo Sabe?
Workers.
That's
we only
Tonto
have...
said that to the Lone Ranger because he was an Indian and he's a cowboy imperialist, whatever.
There's only 10... federally mandated public holidays for U.S. workers. You want to know, there's only 9 in the U.K., but they have 28 days of annual leave mandated nationally. 28 days of federal...
In England?
Yeah.
All right. I got it. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, labor movement used to be strong there.
So that's a total of 36 days off.
They had their own workers' party, labor party.
Right. Yeah. Guaranteed... Yeah. By the British government. Nice. We have no guaranteed days off, right?
Who's we again? American workers.
American workers.
Yeah. Because I think American bosses, they get a lot of time
off. Oh, yeah. I mean, my boss, she gets out, she walks out of her office. It's 3:30. It's right in the middle of the worst part of the workday for us. And she goes, oh yeah, you guys look like you got it handled. I'll take off. I'll see you tomorrow. And we're like, yeah, see you tomorrow.
That doesn't even sound like the big boss. That sounds like a supervisor.
No, yeah, that's our manager.
Yeah, that's the big bosses. I mean,
big boss just announced over email that he's moving to 4 days a week now. So he's only going to grace our presence 4 days a week.
And then it'll be three. And what does he do, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, he hires other people to do his thinking for him. By the way, we keep alluding to a job. So let's start our interview here. We're here interviewing a millennial revolutionary socialist named Nick Wurst, who works in a warehouse.
Yeah.
Warehouse worker.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. I've got a forklift license now. It's my most prized possession.
I didn't know you got that.
Yeah.
That's really good. That's a movable skill.
OSHA certified to operate class 1, 2, and 3 forklifts.
Nice. Nice.
But yeah, I work in a warehouse.
Can't afford a forklift, but you could drive one.
No, I can't afford one.
I understand. That's part of the problem, but of capitalism. But anyway, yeah. So that's great. That's good news. But so you sound like you love your job.
Yeah, it's the best. If you're listening, boss, it's the best job in the world, and I hope that you give me a big raise coming around. No,
Americans are taught to be very positive about their work situations until you get them drunk, and then they tell you it really sucks and their lives are a waste.
You don't have to get me drunk.
We're not drunk. We're not drunk. We didn't have one drink today.
My job sucks.
Yeah, so is mine. Yeah.
Yeah, I started
big time
working here. I started working there, I guess, about a year and a half ago, and started off at minimum wage in Massachusetts, which is $11 an hour. Yeah.
That's the sound of barfing.
And they pulled this really interesting thing about maybe 8 months after I started working. They bumped up the starting rate for warehouse workers in the company to $11.50, but they didn't tell us. So what they did was they brought individually the like eight of us that were still making just basic minimum wage into the office, and then they said, hey, you know, you've been doing a great job recently. We're going to give you a raise. We're bumping you up to $11.50. And every individual one of us kind of left the office feeling good. Oh, yeah, $11.50, that 50 cents is going to add up. You know, this is good. And then we started talking to each other, and we said, wait, you got bumped up to $11.50 too? And then we heard from some other people that they had raised the starting rate for warehouse workers. So it was really insulting to some of those people who have worked there for longer than me, where, you know, we've been doing this work for, you know, for me, it was about 8 months. And I had been, they had been asking me to do all this other stuff, right? Giving me different skills, right?
Mm.
But basically making me a more valuable employee or worker because I can do lots of different things, but not for any more money. And so these, what they're basically
saying.
See, that's
part of, well, you just touched on something interesting. Let's riff on that for a second. That's one of the problems with the whole automation thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can build a robot for a lot of money to build it and maintain it.
And it's only going to be able to do one
and
thing.
And then the next time you want to reprogram it, that's going to cost a lot of money if you can even do that.
Right.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or, you know, that's the problem with automation is that, of course, there's always been a combination of machinery and human labor. But people wonder why under capitalism human labor hasn't disappeared because of the potential to automate more fully or near automate more, or not disappeared but nearly disappeared. Well, because humans are more malleable than machines in every way you can think of. The minute you turn a machine on, it starts to wear down and depreciate, and all the things we already mentioned about it come into play. Whereas with a human being, unfortunately, in the context of capitalism, you can mess with that person in various ways. The wages,
right?
The terror of being jobless and what that means, and just the pressure, psychological brainwashing pressures, etc. Positive psychological incentives, they're supposed to be positive. Training, constant retraining. Where I work, they're constantly changing what we do and not giving us any credit for rolling with that stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's also... Some of us are joking. It's a way to piss off the older workers, like the really older workers. You keep changing things over and over again like that. It's just such a pain.
Yeah.
And you don't really have to. And yet they do it. I don't care. I mean, I roll with it. A lot of people roll with it. But you can see some people just get a little irritated. I don't blame them at all. They're just like, why are you changing this again? We just, you know, got used to this. And they're just, you know, and you're not even training us. Now, the latest thing is to change stuff all the time where I work, but have us train ourselves or each other. So they don't even lose money on training.
It's not my job to educate you.
Yeah.
So that, it actually is.
So you want, after a while, you wonder what the managers are doing. Even the lower level managers, you wonder, gee, they're going to a lot of meetings.
Yeah.
And where I work at Harvard University, which is a crappy place to work, by the way, and it's like the second or third largest employer in the exploiter of labor in the state of Massachusetts, they are they're not hiring enough. They're outsourcing. They're cutting. It's just a horrible, horrible corporation. It's not a nonprofit. It's not really an educational institution. It's a training ground.
What's the size of their endowment again? I mean,
it's up to like $42 billion or something. Yeah. But the thing you have to understand about when people talk about Harvard's endowment is there are many other sources of income too that are in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Look at their real estate empire. That's not even the endowment.
How much?
They own most of Austin.
What's the percentage of Cambridge that's actually just Harvard property at this point?
Oh, that's a good question. Cambridge and Austin combined, you've got quite a big neighborhood. You could call Harvardlandia or something.
Yeah, it's amazing.
With its own cops and everything else, you know.
But they're their own city government at this point.
Harvard sucks. That's true in so many ways. But what was that figure now? About 38% of Harvard grads go onto Wall Street, immediately jump into Wall Street now. You know?
I wouldn't be surprised.
They're teaching them a lot of important stuff there. How to exploit, how to move money around to get more money.
How to do 2007, just, 2008 again, but worse this time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then not go to jail for it again.
Yeah, but just before we riffed on Harvard, what were we talking about?
Oh, yeah, the raise that wasn't a raise.
No, there was something else.
Automation,
there was something. Yeah, okay, anyway, good. Well, let's go back to the main point of the interview, without a segue. So here you are. Warehouse worker. Before that, you were going to college off and on.
Biggest mistake of my life.
Because of the prohibitive cost or the brainwashing that ensues or all of the above or whatever.
It's a lot of stuff. I mean, when you think about it, because it used to be with college.
Oh, you went to high school in Worcester.
Yeah.
Public high school in Worcester.
I went through, starting in fourth grade, because I moved to Worcester the summer before fourth grade. I've been through the Worcester Public Schools all the way up. So from fourth grade, middle school, high school.
And when you were in the Worcester Public Schools, just a quick little look at that. Any mention of the word socialism anywhere? Any knowledge of that from the school, not from your parents or whatever?
I think aside from, like, you know, it popping up in history textbooks with, like, the one paragraph about who Karl Marx is or who what the Soviet Union was or whatever, and this is actually the beginning of where I started to get political was in the first year of high school. I had a
Would that be ninth grade or tenth grade from your point of view?
Ninth grade.
Start getting interested in socialism. Why?
So I had a history teacher who did this. I mean, it's terrible. It's awful, the actual content, but it was enough to sort of spark my interest. So he drew up on the whiteboard sort of three columns, and at the top of each column he put capitalism, socialism, and communism. And he said, all right, so this is what each of these is. And he says, capitalism is when private individuals or individuals, I don't think he even said private, individuals control the means of production.
He used those actual words. Thank you, teacher.
Right. And
I
then
control
everybody,
the means of production.
Right. Everybody said, you know, what are the means of production,
okay,
et cetera.
Make more popcorn. Yeah. Now.
It's that easy.
When
he said individual, right, obviously everybody starts going, oh, individual, I'm an individual, that's good, right? So then he says socialism. He says socialism is when there's a mix between individuals and the government.
The government. Owning, and who likes big government?
No, nobody likes big government, right? And then he said, so communism is when the government owns everything.
Oh,
right?
Boo, hiss.
So in terms of how you can explain socialism, communism, those concepts, that's one of the worst ones I've heard, but yeah, it seems to be pretty standard throughout the
probably
U.S.
a textbook
education
from
system.
Texas.
I
think in like Dallas somebody wrote those. Well, let's look at that for a second. This is great. I love this. All right. So, well, okay. So we've already debunked just by talking about popcorn making.
Right.
The fact that we as individual workers
have so much control
do not own
over
the means
economy.
Of production.
Right,
that's not okay. And most of your, if you think because you own stock through your pension plan, you own the means of production, go to a shareholders meeting if you can find it.
Try to get yourself
and
get what you want.
And try to get in the room and then try to get what you want in that room. Just do it. And then we'll have a talk about democracy and shareholder democracy.
Right.
So go, you bunch of wahoos or whatever you are that believe in that. Go try that and then we'll talk. Now what's the second thing? Socialism is what? Part government, part private. Okay. Well, what they never talk about, because I listen to right-wing radio and stuff, and they talk about the government liberals, which is kind of a joke. We'll get into that maybe later. And socialists, they want more government, right? And we're taught that government is bad. And this government is bad.
Yeah,
you don't have to talk to me about that. This government is really horrible. It's a capitalist government. What? Yeah, it's a government controlled by capitalists, by the owners of the means of production, the less than 1%.
Those aforementioned private individuals,
which is not very many private individuals.
Right.
But here's the point I wanted to make, though. Right, listen carefully, please, listeners. There are different types of governments.
Whoa.
Not all governments are the same. A government based on a slave society, or government based on feudal production, or government based on capitalist production, these are different types of governmental systems that come into play. Under feudalism, you could have a king and queen, and that worked really well for the king and queen and the nobility, right? And
eventually, they kept all their little nobles happy
as long as they had economic control, right? Over through ownership of land and God saying that was their land, of course. You got to bring God into
the divine right to rule.
Just like Christians now and others will say God, you know, is behind capitalism.
Right.
If Jesus never existed, but if Jesus had existed, Jesus would have been a capitalist or whatever. So anyway, then you've got the slave societies run, you know, by slave owners, by dictatorships, you know, except for that little, we're taught the cradle of democracy was Greece, where that was a slave society. Mm-hmm. Some of the slave owners got together and talked to each other until the next warlord came along and just wiped that out or whatever. But, you know, there's other governments.
Yeah.
There's governments called workers' governments.
Right.
Like the beginning of the Soviet Union. Or the French, the Paris Commune. For a short time, but it was there for about 6 weeks. The Spanish Revolution, parts of Spain liberated from capitalism. People start to create a new type of government, one that's accountable to the people, one that you vote for everybody. You vote for things, the people that are in government, instead of having most people appointed, like in our so-called democracy, where people don't get special privileges and wages for being in government, but they are there because they want to be part of the movement, to help the movement, you know, to help the workers' government, where they can be recalled, you know, at any time. If they're not doing their job, you just say, no, okay, we're having a vote to recall you and put someone else in. Positions are rotated, you know. You don't have to have the same person, the same position all the time. And you don't have this army, this and these police and everyone and all the people with guns back, you know, I'm talking about organized people with guns, backing up the state, and the ruling class. Instead, you have the people that can defend themselves. They do their own defense and their own organizing for keeping things, keeping society running, basically, against attacks from outside or from crime or whatever, you know. And that there's been governments like this for short times. Usually they're attacked. There are different types of government. So every time I'm, you know, driving and I hear like right wing radio say big government, they don't differentiate between different types of governments. Even within a capitalist economic system, there are different types of governments.
Yeah,
you know, based on the amount of engagement, the amount of fighting between the classes, and political warfare that happens, and how much, like in Europe, where the unions and there's workers' parties are still stronger, where there's stronger unions for now, it's changing, and workers' parties that workers have managed to gain more things like vacation time, like we were talking about earlier. So that's a kind of different type of government in some ways not so different because it's still run by the capitalists, but it's capitalists that are under siege a little more than the capitalists here, which are just running rampant over us.
And even there, you know, there's still a lot of monarchies out there or places that still
have... Well, the vestiges, the last...
still have...
symbolic,
elements of nobility there. So even then, when you know, whoever Alex Jones or whoever else says big government, there's not only all those differences between, like, the American government and British government, or, like, when you say big government, are you talking about, like, you know, Saudi Arabia, where you have... the sort of a monarchy that's latched itself into the 21st century. Big government, And but it's still not exactly the same as U.S. government, So what are you talking about when you say...
What kind of big government?
And there's this is the
other
thing.
They don't talk about that.
Right, this is the other
thing. Because
they're
just there to brainwash people and make them stupid, you know?
I hate big government. Here we go. I'm on record as saying I hate big government.
Depends what kind of government.
Right, exactly. What are the elements of the government that get the most money? Right? I mean, look at it this way. If we're talking about big government isn't like isn't Social Security. Big government in terms of the amount of
the
money
military.
Right, that's going somewhere is the
it's
military.
Corporate welfare.
It's corporate welfare. Yeah. It's handouts. Yeah. It's all that stuff.
Yep.
You know, you talk about freeloaders in our society. Like
big
you
corporations.
You think the guys on the street corner, you know, asking for money are
nothing like the Obama bailouts.
Freeloaders. Yeah,
that was
exactly.
The biggest
talk about freeloaders. They walked in to Washington, D.C., all these corporate execs in their suits and everything, you know, they don't look like the guys on the streets. They walk into the White House and they shake their little cup, their little martini glass, and the government sticks a big fat check in there and says, you go ahead, go try again.
Yeah.
Lay off all your workers. Screw them all over.
Yeah, get rid of their pensions.
Yeah.
You know.
Go try
destroy
again.
Destroy their communities, their towns, cities.
How many second chances have you gotten from the White House, Jeff? How many times has Obama written you a bailout check?
Never.
How many times has Trump written you a bailout check?
Never.
Helped you out?
Never.
Here's a second chance, Jeff. Your car broke down. You know, here's
hey, your student
here's
loans are forgiven.
Yeah,
hey,
here's your stimulus package, right?
I'm still waiting for a stimulus package, but I'm not holding my breath. So, anyway, so you heard this ridiculous thing from a ridiculous teacher, and there are many of them, unfortunately. And the teachers are our brothers and sisters in the labor movement, no doubt about it. But some of them, every once in a while when I interview someone about how they became a socialist, I hear of a good teacher
that actually
risking their jobs, risking their lives maybe in some places, actually talked about what real socialism is. And by the way, then socialism... for a real socialist or a real revolutionary socialist, socialism is a step towards communism, where you wouldn't even have a government, you wouldn't need it anymore because you wouldn't need the essence of a government, which is that
government exists.
The armed violence you would need in a new revolutionary socialist tradition to keep the counter-revolution from coming back. Like the Russian Revolution was invaded by 19 imperialist armies, including the United States, for example. But under a long period of socialism where you're creating an equal society, equality, and by the way, some people say equality means sameness.
Yeah.
In a certain sense it does, but in a sense of social society, it means everyone has basically a decent life and what they need.
Right.
And there would still be differences, of course, in the way people express themselves or what they feel their needs are. And that could be worked out in different ways democratically. And then working to a point where the idea that everyone has a right to a decent life is so ingrained in the way we function.
That you know, don't the need production, a state to back
the, yeah,
it
the
up.
Production goes for human, for the people and not for profit, that you don't need, you don't have any hordes of gold to protect. You don't have any gated communities you got to worry about
someone,
a capitalist, you know?
Someone once described it as the state exists or needs to exist at the point where they're... is a difference between the haves and the have-nots, right? The state comes into existence when there is one group of people that has everything to lose and wants to protect it.
Right.
Right. And that's the basis of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really it was really kind of educational for me at one point where...
Well, we'll go back, jump back. Okay, I'm just going to interrupt. Sorry to interrupt. But I wanted to go back to the... I don't know why I'm interested in the chronology. I guess I am.
Yeah.
So you hear this crazy... you sense something's wrong with this explanation about socialism, capitalism, socialism, communism. What was the next thing?
Well, the next thing was for a lot of high school, I sort of started thinking of myself as a communist, just because after that class I went... And I think I pulled out the old encyclopedia in my parents' attic and read through it. And, like, it was Encyclopedia Britannica or something, some really old copy. And it actually had a really interesting sort of entry about communism, where it summarized fairly well, kind of what Marx was talking about.
And that
about.
Happens. Sometimes dictionary definitions of socialism or communism are pretty accurate sometimes.
Right.
And people, that's their entree to
and
it.
And the way that, my teachers reacted to this, my parents and stuff was, he's a young kid. He's an idealist. Right. And communism, even when it's written by Encyclopedia Britannica, sounds good. It makes sense, right? It sounds like a good thing to work towards.
Equal society, yeah.
Right, exactly. And so...
Equality in society.
Yeah, after... I didn't do much reading beyond that. I just kind of, I was a punk in high school, right? I was sort of...
Did the music turn you left at all? Was that part of it?
Yeah, that was a certain element of it. I think a lot of...
The Worcester punk scene, are there any lefties? Or are they all... Like
yeah,
skinheads.
There's a lot of anarchists in the Worcester punk scene, like there is in any punk scene.
So they have some politics, somehow, yeah. Sort of. Yeah, okay.
But so I think communism kind of just fit in with like the whole loner thing, the outsider thing. But then when I went after I graduated high school and I headed off to college in Florida, I had gotten a scholarship to this. Private engineering university where I was supposed to be studying aerospace engineering.
Wow.
So I did this because, if you want to talk idealist, I thought
You're like Elon Musk, you want to give all your money to space.
No. I thought
there's no money though. But,
yeah, I thought NASA could be turned into like Starfleet and all this other
nice.
Stuff. I was
Me
this
too.
Dumb
it
hopeful kid and I was like, yeah, space
After
exploration, science is the way forward. All that stuff. And I went there, and one of the first classes that... So this is a private university. I could only go because of the scholarship, and
right,
that's why
right.
I stopped going eventually. But a lot of rich kids, a lot of kids coming from well-off families with industry connections and stuff like that. And the campus itself was very corporate. It was also very militarized. This place has... It's Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. So one of the big things it has a pilots program. And it actually has the second largest class of Air Force cadets outside of the Air Force Academy. ROTC is a huge thing on campus. But there was also all this corporate stuff.
Did I ever tell you I was in ROTC?
I'm not surprised.
I'll tell you about that in a minute. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
My grandpa was in ROTC too. He said he loved it. so...
Oh, dear.
The place was very corporate as well. You had, because a big thing in engineering and in STEM in general is getting internships and stuff like that. So lots of companies would get invited.
What's STEM?
Okay, so science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
This is the wave of the future.
Yeah,
you get your degree in STEM and you'll be a millionaire.
It's what they've been pushing since the 90s, ever since the dot-com bubble kicked off.
Yeah.
But they're not actually willing to pay STEM workers any
real sarcastic.
Amount of money. Yeah, exactly. So there were always companies, especially defense companies, private space companies that would come on campus and put on like it was almost like a trade show, right? You walk in and they all have their booths showing off their products, and then you pass them your resume and you're like, hey, can I get an internship, all that stuff. But early on, one of the first classes I had, the teacher, the professor, she said at one point, she said, you guys who are entering this field, you have to be okay with the fact that the majority of jobs available in aerospace is in weapons, is defense industry, is...
Did anyone have a problem with that?
Drones and stuff. And
anyone raise their hand and say, sorry.
Looked shaken. I was still sort of holding out hope. I was like, no, I'll be the one guy that NASA can afford to hire, you know, when I graduate. It's all bull crap.
So you're still thinking about communism. You go to the engineering school,
and they're
talking about drones and stuff. Yeah,
it sucked.
And you see the uniforms everywhere. Yeah.
I had some friends, but a lot of people I just couldn't identify with. They, you know, rich kids' dad bought them their muscle car or whatever. Mm. They had never worked before. They didn't need to get a job. All this stuff, and so what I started doing was I started staying in my room and going on the internet and reading.
I had friends like that in college.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. But before the internet, they did other things in their room. Listen to music.
Yeah,
but,
I did a lot of that.
Yeah, so you're on the internet.
So I'm on the internet, and I start searching around, and I find stuff like the Marxist Internet Archive. I find stuff like on Reddit. There's a community, a subreddit titled Socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And I start reading about all these left groups. I start reading Marx for the first time
directly
off the Internet Archive.
Yeah,
yeah, and I'm starting to, I don't know, I'm not doing my homework a whole lot.
But
I've also kind of lost any interest in it. The whole thing just kind of sucks. I was in, you know, just personally, I was depressed. I didn't see, my grades were slipping. I didn't see a way out, all that stuff. Yeah. And so.
But this, can you say one materialistic kind of observation on college? For a lot of people, it's the only time in your life, in the U.S. at least, where you're not going to have to work all the time. Now, some people, of course, go to college and have jobs.
Yeah.
But you still get some time to think.
Right.
You know, and that's so rare
in
the United States, because otherwise you get locked into the job.
Yeah.
Or trying to find a job. And you just, and you have no resource. You don't have a library you can walk to. You don't have someone cooking your meals for you.
I've never been able to read as much over the last 2 years working full time as I did when I was in college. It really sucks.
Having someone making your meals for you, I'm not saying that in a bad way.
Yeah.
Call it privilege if you want, and it is. But think about the angle I'm coming at it from is that we're all forced to chase all the working class people are forced to chase money, forced to sell our labor to survive. And that, and once you get a job or you're trying to sell yourself, sell your labor, you have a lot of, you have no time left over, Harley. And then you add a family to that or something. I mean, come on. So college, wait a minute. And you know, and this is, Marxists talk about this. Trotsky wrote about this. College, even for the ruling class kids that don't have to work all the time, it's still a break from their parents and their expectations of the bourgeois to take over the company or become another professional or something like that, you know? So for both the bourgeois kids and the working class kids, you get this amazing time, however short, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 years. Most Americans don't finish college that go. You get to read, for example, if you're a reader. Nowadays, with all the electronic gizmos, like that one I see in front of you.
Yeah, you can't see it, but he's pointing at my laptop and my phone.
I'm not so sure people read anymore, but they used to. You do still, I know. So that's a powerful, powerful thing.
Yeah.
And if everyone that went to college and ended up, having that time that you had, where you actually got interested in something else, that's a significant number of people.
Yeah.
You know, because I've had friends that went through what you did. I read about it. I happened to pick an easy major, so, and you know, I was an English major, right?
Oh man.
I like to read, so I'll do more reading. It was. I liked it. I loved college, actually. I really loved it, but not for the reasons that you're supposed to love it.
Right.
As a step towards a career.
It's,
you know?
It's one of the few times in our lives if you do
I
get
love
to
that
go
freedom.
Where you're
yeah.
To a certain extent they encourage critical thinking.
To a certain extent, right?
Some of the
majors, not all. But right.
It's the exact opposite of, you know, because now I've gone to college and I've been working full time for over a year now, and I had jobs in and out of college and stuff like that. This also gets to your point earlier where you were talking about democracy. Think about the fact that if I'm at work for a 45 to 50 hour week, I spend probably
plus the commute
the most
plus eating food
but the point is while I'm at work, that's probably the longest conscious chunk of time I have in the week where I'm actually like awake and stuff.
Most of the energy's going to that,
But think about it. People say we live in a democracy. I spend most of my week at this job, right? That's fair to say. I spend most of my time at this job. I do not get a single vote. There was a coworker.
Corporations are incredibly authoritarian.
Right.
There was least free places you could be.
There was a coworker that I was just joking with one time, where I said, you know, I think because what you were talking about, management always loves to have brilliant new ideas, right, and change things up, and it drops production like a brick because then we have to adjust to it. But I was saying, hey, I think this is actually a really dumb idea, and he said, well, it's a good thing that we don't have a vote here. We don't get it. This isn't a democracy. Mm-hmm. I said, I vote against this. He said, well, it's not a democracy. And I said, think about that for a minute.
Yeah.
You know, because it's one of those times where you say something and you start to realize what you've actually said. We spend the majority of our time living in a dictatorship.
Absolutely.
That's what the workplace is.
Dictatorship of big business, corporate dictatorship.
Right. Yep. And talking about how college encourages a certain amount of critical thinking, that's the exact opposite of what the workplace does. Is the workplace tells you
obedience,
perform like a robot,
or think for the company. The worst is these middle level people that internalize everything about the company, even if it's a company that, and it's hard to think of one that makes something useful, truly useful, without a prohibitive way of doing it or a rotten way of gaining from it. But you know, basically a lot of middle-level professionals, they'll internalize the values of the corporation. So they'll be just horrible to each other and to the workers, thinking that it's for some sort of greater good, not understanding how capitalism works and how the so-called market works. And yet that becomes the way they look at the world. And whereas workers, I think, at least some of them, even if they can't explain how things work, some can, but even if one can't explain how things work, they aren't buying into it all the way, hopefully.
Yeah.
I don't know. Some do, but some don't.
Everybody, all my experiences, people are cynical about the company. I mean, the minute they start saying something, we all just kind of look at each other and laugh about it. You know, we do this, we have this little game where we time the manager when she has meetings in her office.
Oh, God.
We sit there and we look at our watches and we say, okay, they're going in. And then 45 minutes later, right, they come out and we go, imagine all the work they could have been doing right there.
By the way, mentioning that and some of the things you told me, it sounds like there's a lot of other millennials, young people working in that warehouse.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably 75% of us are under the age of 30. Actually in the warehouse. Sales is a different story, but most of us are young. A lot of us never went to college. For a lot of people, this is just what they've been doing since they got out of high school.
Yep.
Or they've been floating around sort of the job market and working somewhere for a few months and then getting fired from there and getting a job here.
By the way, when we were talking about college, I wasn't trying to sell college based on I really liked it, it was fun for me, because I understand there's a huge cost literally of the money, but also people have other things that are that to do, like take care of your family, stay around and take care of your family, or do something you actually like to do that the college might not be part of. And college education might not be part of getting to do that. And the thing with paying for that time, that free time, they make you pay dearly for
it. Oh, yeah.
Even back when I went to school, I paid for only 2 years worth, because I went for 2 years without having to take out a loan, and 2 years where I took out loans. The 2 years I took out loans.
And that was back before loans were a big business. They were just starting.
No, they were already a big business, but they were more regulated than they are now, and the prices weren't as high.
Yeah.
But everyone took out a loan if you went to a big school, you know, expensive. There were still expensive schools,
right?
And the school expense was way above what workers could afford. So you either got scholarships or loans or both. So that's where ROTC comes in, which I'll mention in a second. But so anyway, the loan thing is 13 years paying off the fun 2 years I had at one place, and the not so fun 2 years I had another place where I didn't have to was cheaper, but I didn't have the loans. But yeah, ROTC was going to be the way, like a lot of people are where I'm from.
Economic conscription.
Yeah, the army, either getting the armed forces directly as a job route, or ROTC, that's for officers, Reserve Officer Training Corps, to get scholarship money for college.
Yeah.
And the way it's organized, or the way it was organized, was the first year you get to decide whether you want to stay or not.
Right.
And they're not giving you any money yet, but you're taking these free courses and blah, 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 which are a combination of like physical stuff and what the Army considers intellectual.
Yeah.
Like pop psychology. It's kind of like, capitalist, it's kind of like a capitalist agenda within the Army of, you know, getting people to,
any god awful
pop psychology in business, basically.
Any god awful like corporate leadership seminar that you've ever had to be to, that's the entirety of the U.S. military's like officer leadership stuff is like.
Well, except for if you go to West Point or something.
Right, treat your soldiers like team members and discuss the goal. And
or there's other theories, but yeah, you're right. And basically, what I found in ROTC. And I'm not sure about the people you went to school with, if they stuck it out or not, but I quit before they got me, which was a good thing in retrospect, because the U.S. Imperialism amped up its interventions right after I graduated.
Yeah.
The Vietnam War thing was wearing off, and it's Panama, let's go down there.
Yeah.
There's,
invaded Grenada, Jeff.
Grenada, yeah. Let's invade Grenada, Panama, and then, they start taking off more places. I think Beirut might have been soon. I don't know. I'd have to go back to that time period, but... the thing was, though, that it was interesting. What I found out through working a union job, and we'll get into this maybe later, a union job allowed me to make more money, enough money, let's say, to go to college.
Yeah.
So I didn't need ROTC for at least those first 2 years.
Yeah.
And then later, the combination of that union job plus loans. And then also within that paradigm of ROTC was some real dangerous foolishness, like officers that are something out of MASH or something, but with power.
Yeah.
So you have to really ask yourself, if you're awake enough to figure this out, I think some of us were, you have to ask yourself, do I want to make life or death decisions, putting other people in jeopardy as an officer, based on the chain of command?
Right.
Based on this major, because I had a major there on campus, and he was a complete idiot, and I'm not exaggerating. I mean, he was just a moron, and he's a vicious moron too. So I'm like, well, I'm going to be somewhere maybe ordering people to do horribly vicious things, based on his orders. And if I say no, I'm court-martialed and whatever,
Yeah, you can be. This is the thing.
It was ridiculous.
You don't get fired from the military. You get court-martialed, and there's still the death penalty out
and
there.
Prison,
you can get,
death
you
penalty,
can get shot for disobeying
dishonorable
orders.
Discharge. Where were you the last 4 years when you go to a job interview? What was your discharge?
I was dishonorably discharged.
And then there was
good luck finding a job.
Yeah, and then there was this thing of not just craziness, evil craziness, but then like when you enter back, this is when they were reinstituting the draft or trying to. So it hadn't gone to any kind of it hadn't been reinstituted yet when I started, but it was in the wind, and so they had you sign, and probably this is before that too, they had you sign a piece of paper when you first entered saying you would not declare yourself a conscientious objector in the event of war, and that you could be called up to active duty as a member of ROTC. So they're gonna dip into the like high school kids,
the reserves
marching around, and the college kids marching around and stuff like that. So. I wanted that piece of paper back. I signed it to get in. I wanted it back when I decided to leave. And the same major who was a complete idiot decided to play games with it. Did I ever tell you this story? So anyway, I went into his office, and I did a little occupation of my own. I wouldn't leave because I tried many times before through the regular, through his secretary, and then talking and running into him on campus. Hey, I'd like to get that piece of paper. Blah, blah. So finally, I'm sitting in, and I'm I really can't leave till I get that piece of paper. And he sort of looked at me. There's that who's gonna draw first?
The tumbleweed rolls by in the background.
The music starts from the good, the bad, the ugly.
Yeah.
All over a little piece of paper, right? And then he goes, "Oh, it's right here."
Yeah.
So that was the little fun he got to tell me that he had just messed with me. It's right here. He opens up a file drawer, hands me the paper. I go back to my dorm and call some friends of mine. And we just burn it in my sink, and yeah. I'm free. Yay, no more ROTC. Well, I still had friends in ROTC, though, and they weren't free, unfortunately. But all the different ways to enjoy that little college experience where you don't have to work, you do pay a price for it, unless you're from the rich.
But, well, I'll say this.
But I still say to have some time to read. I still have some of my fondest memories. Not my fondest. Don't think I'm too much of a nerd. But some of my fondest memories were being in the library at both schools that I went to and just reading. Reading like magazines and reading a book and like, oh, wow. Okay, I spent the morning reading. Cool.
I don't want to trash talk college too much because, you know, call me an idealist, whatever. Education, I think, is inherently a good thing.
And, yeah, but the bourgeois...
Right.
Sorry to interrupt, but the bourgeois are clearly the government. The big bad government. Capitalist government, by the way, is rolling back education. You can see it, higher education. They're just rolling it back. I mean, when they have this discussion, they talk about how, oh, we really don't think everyone needs college anymore. A good trade school for you, pat, 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 you know, on the head. And they don't really care if that's good for you or not. They just want more people to exploit in that field, whatever it is, like high-tech manufacturing or something. You know what I mean? So every talk show you can listen to when the bourgeois gets involved, when the corporate media gets involved on college, their idea is rationing.
Yeah.
That's their idea now. Rationing it for the working class and having it for the elites. Oh, it used to be extremely restricted.
When it began, right, way back in the medieval era, college started, and when it got modernized, you know, throughout the 19th century and all that, it started as a way for the capitalists to reproduce themselves.
But I would argue
you send your kids
capitalist
to school,
class to reproduce
right the capitalist.
But I would argue that really in the United States, and I don't know about other countries, but it's probably similar. That didn't get blown up a little bit until World War II and after. Really after. The GI Bill is what popularized college and the post-war upswing. That's what created the community college system and everything else. Before that, it was extremely elitist.
And now it's like they're trying to get back to those roots.
Yeah,
right?
They are.
Try to roll it back. Yeah. And
it's not fair. I mean, even if a lot of millennials have illusions that don't match up to the reality of college, they have a right to education. Everyone has a right to education.
I think just
the exact opposite's happening in this country. You have to pay for this right. No, you don't pay for rights in terms of money.
Right.
You earn those rights. You have those rights as a citizen.
And the way it should work.
As a person, as a human.
The way it should work is everyone should get the opportunity and chance to be able to try out college. Right?
Absolutely.
And cost is prohibitive, right? When you say we live in a free society, all right, then just make the decision to go to college. You can't do that, right? You have to do all the accounting. You have to figure out, can you afford this? You know,
it's horrible. Yeah.
What are all these loans?
Even it's applying is expensive.
Right. It's not a free choice.
Excuse me, time consuming.
When you think about it, I mean, this is something I keep coming back to. German metal workers just want a 28-hour work week.
Yeah.
If you're working your job 28 hours,
it's still too much.
It's still too much. But you can. I mean, you could take a few college classes at night. You could be working this good, high-paying, you know,
you could do some reading
job, right? You could be doing some reading. You could, who knows? Maybe you really like art or whatever. You could be teaching yourself something. You could be taking university classes. You can be working and still be giving your brain a little bit of exercise and giving yourself the opportunity. But we don't have that choice, right? Not realistically.
Nope.
Because they always say you have the choice.
It's also not just a matter of free time. It's a matter of free time where you can pay your bills.
Yeah.
Because if you can't, or just survive, if you can't, I know that trying to find a job or find housing or find all these things you need to survive would take up the time of not working. When I was unemployed, it wasn't like I got a lot done because I was always fearful of of not finding another job. I mean, it was looking back, unreasonable fear somewhat, but you don't know. I mean, individuals can slip through the cracks in the society and go off and die very easily, you know?
Right.
And I was in a city, big city with no family and nowhere. I had just had to survive on my own. And there's no guarantee of getting another job. There's no guarantee. So unemployment was not like, oh, free time to do this or that. and also I found when I was unemployed, I was under so much stress that somehow things like slowed down in my head. So like if I had one errand to do, it would take so long. Uh-huh. Oh, I gotta go to the post office today. Okay.
Yep.
And that is about noon, and I'm like, at least I went to the post office. Now what? And I gotta go fill out more job applications or whatever, and or go to this interview, you know?
You feel worse and worse about yourself, and you get slower and slower. And
well, you're right. But I never felt that self-critical that I was like doing something wrong or something, or like I didn't have confidence. I just felt like, I felt it added to my politics at the time, to my socialist politics. But I discovered in retrospect later that it wasn't an easy time, and it started to feel that way too. I'm like, I'm not getting much done. I'm getting isolated. I can't afford to do anything. I just was experiencing sort of a contraction of my world at the time. You know, have you been unemployed at all? You were looking for that job for a while, weren't you?
Yeah. I have.
Was that fun?
No, it's not fun, man. You fill out so, it was like applying, it felt like applying to college all over again, except worse. You fill out all these applications, and you send them off, and they don't even tell you if they reject you, right? You don't get a phone call from someone saying, hey, just to let you know, we're not considering hiring you. So, you know, you send out like 20 job applications, and you're sitting there thinking, like, you know, hey, maybe some of these are still in the system. People are still working through them. And then you go send out more, and you don't hear anything for weeks, for months. And, you know, if your parents can afford to take care of you, that's one thing. A lot of people have a lot of problems with that. And it sucks because you basically, they give you a form, and it's the same form that everybody else has to fill out. And if you really get down to it, what it's saying is boil yourself as an individual down to like all these easily fill outable little boxes, and then send that to someone, and that person way over there who's never met you or anything is gonna look at this sheet and look at all these other sheets of all these other people, and based on just what's in those boxes, say, yeah, they're worth bringing in for an interview.
See if they'll be a good fit. Right. You ever hear that?
Exactly.
We think you'd be a good fit here, or not? I mean, be a good fit.
And so you get this awful feeling of being like scrutinized at a distance, and you have to try to sell yourself. You have to present yourself in the best positive light.
That's where you have to swallow up capitalism and make it part of your being.
Yeah.
And that's where I can't do that. So that's why I tended to stay at the same job for a long time. Yeah. Or not have to go. I somehow managed to get all my jobs without resumes. I don't know how that worked, but it's how it's happened. Not one resume has passed
into
employer's hands.
Present your skills in a way that will convince people that you will make money for them.
Yes, exactly.
And it's the worst feeling in the world.
And they keep changing the criteria for what you should put in them and all that. And I, you know, I hear about them. And one time, my wife started to create one for me, and I'm just like, I don't do job interviews. It's just too. I have done them, but I think I did them. I hit the times like now when there was a lot of jobs, you know, for those temporary moments,
right?
Or the jobs were so basic that they didn't need to have that kind of fancy stuff. You know, they look at me and they're, he seems not to be
does
high.
Does he have two arms, two legs?
Yeah. Right. He's young.
Right.
And he was young and he's not high, and yeah, okay, you'll do. Yeah. I had a security guard job. I think that's all they were looking for, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, so we're on the path to socialism for you, and you think you're a socialist already.
Yeah.
And you're about to drop out of college. That's where we ended.
Yeah. So what happened then?
But you had some time to read. Yay.
Yeah. So I started reading. You know, I started reading Marx and Engels, and then from then on, everything kind of branches out, and there's all these different people out there, all these different you know, when you say socialist or
political
whatever.
Groups, are you talking about political groups,
right?
Or
political groups, but also pundits, historical people. Figures okay, and people yeah, like yeah. that. Everybody has their own take on Marxism or socialism or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm reading, and I'm starting to read Lenin, and I'm having this hard time where I'm reading Lenin and I'm going, wow, this guy makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And then I'm thinking about what I learned in high school, and Lenin's this evil guy who like killed everybody or whatever. I'm just, this doesn't add up.
Nope.
And I start researching like the Soviet Union and Lenin, and I find out that it wasn't just Lenin died and then Stalin took over and everybody was cool with it. I found out that Lenin was actually pretty cool, and the early Soviet Union was actually pretty cool. And when Lenin dies, there's this power struggle.
And it wasn't just Lenin. Lenin was part of this party.
Right.
And this party was part of the Soviets. What are those? Well, those are mass workers' councils and peasant councils.
Right.
And the Bolsheviks got elected, Lenin's party got elected into the leadership of those things. And they were trying to create a society based on these massive, most democratic things that ever existed, institutions that ever existed in history.
Right. Imagine if
Soviets, which means councils.
Imagine if all your coworkers, all your neighbors, everybody in the community got together for big meetings and voted on everything and discussed everything.
Or sent representatives to those meetings. Yeah, or, like the neighborhood association or something.
Yeah, you elect like one guy out.